Several generations of Kirk blacksmiths and iron founders preceded the birth of Peter Kirk in 1840. At the dawn of the Victorian era, that inspired the Second Industrial Revolution. From an early age, he worked in the family ironworks alongside his brothers, father, grandfather, uncles, and cousins. As a young man, his family moved north to Workington, where he and his brothers started a new ironworks. After a bumpy start trying to align the specific chemistry of the local ores with their family's historical process, they gained a reputation for making superb wrought iron in the area. In his mid-20s, Peter experienced a series of life-changing events. First, he married Marianne Quirk, daughter of a successful shoemaker. They had 9 children, 8 of which came to America with them. Marianne was involved with some of Peter's business ventures. She had her own investment portfolio and was instrumental in buffeting the family through the hard times with her inheritance. Second, Peter left the family business to branch out with his brother-in-law, Charles James Valentine. Their ironworks evolved into Moss Bay Hematite Iron and Steel Company, one of the first Bessemer steel plants in northwest England. He strove for efficiency in his ironworks. For example, early on, his plant was one of the first to use ladle cars to directly transport the molten ore from the blast furnaces to the Bessemer converters. This eliminated the need to reheat the pig iron in steel production. He captured the waste heat from the blast furnaces to fuel 25 of the 30 boilers that powered the many machines on site. He used the latent heat of cooling ingots to make an oven to cool them evenly, which in turn increased the steel quality. This company lasted over 100 years, despite England's diminishing market share that plagued the country starting in the late 19th century. I believe it was able to survive in part due to Peter Kirk's many innovations he put into the mill during his time. The third life-changing event happened when Peter was 26 years old. He registered the first of over a dozen patents that mainly addressed fuel and labor saving, but also included new rail products. His patents addressed every phase of steel production, from simple but uniquely designed grates to preserve embers from the blast furnace, to the mechanism that automatically fed coal to continuously fuel that fire, to the oven to temper the ingots, to the complex rolling mills to get as many rolls with one heat of the ingot as possible. His many inventions included finished products such as special tram rails and steel sleepers and their hardware. The latter reduced the amount of steel used and made it faster for the railroad companies to install. Moss Bay was world-renowned for its innovations and quality products. They enjoyed international success, with Moss Bay rails laid all over Great Britain and many of its Commonwealth nations. They supplied rails to build the Canadian Pacific Railway, many lines in the United States, and Mexico. In 1886, Moss Bay shipped 250,000 steel sleepers to India alone. Yet Britain started losing market share to the U.S. as America went gangbusters on their continental expansion. The U.S. imposed high tariffs on foreign iron and steel, making it even harder for the European producers. Peter Kirk came to America in 1886 to investigate how to gain a foothold in its exploding development, with the possibility of building a subsidiary. He planned a grand tour of the best industrial plants. When visiting the Pennsylvania mills, he was asked about his purpose and mentioned that, quote, business was so dull in England that they had come to America to see what was the cause of it. Kirk further explained, a new era has dawned for America, and I am afraid a period of darkness for England. With the facilities of cheap coal, natural gas, easily accessible ores, and limitless abundance of freight transportation, England can no longer compete with America in iron products. However, Moss Bay did have an order for several tons of rails that intrigued Kirk. Located on the West Coast, the Seattle Lakeshore and Eastern Railroad had included ore analysis for the Denny mines with their order. Kirk added an extension to his fact-finding mission to cross the continent to Washington Territory. Once there, Kirk saw opportunity. It was 1,600 miles closer to western U.S. lines that needed periodic replacement and were also expanding. He also calculated the untapped exposure to emerging markets in Asia, Central, and South Americas. Kirk's initial assessment of the needed materials and logistics proved hopeful to build a steel mill in the area, but there were challenges. He got tangled up in a frontier town rivalry between Seattle, who controlled the best iron deposits, and Tacoma, who controlled the most rail infrastructure with Northern Pacific Railroad. To have access to the high-quality but limited iron ore, he had to make Seattle the place of production and distribution. But Northern Pacific had the railroad miles connecting Tacoma and a huge ore deposit in Cleland to its advantage. Kirk's status as an immigrant also caused wrinkles in his plan. He had many backers in England, but if the new company was funded mainly with foreign capital, the law considered it foreign and subject to the tariffs Kirk was trying to avoid. These problems were overcome with the help of Lee S. J. Hunt, and in the summer of 1888, frantic work began in building the fledgling town of Kirkland and its mill site. Kirk bought and stored on site about 5,600 tons of machinery and supplies. He also bought a coal mine and brokered a deal with Northern Pacific Railroad to hedge his bets. All along, Kirk's project struggled with capital. The Seattle Fire of 1889 didn't help by drawing all available investment to rebuilding Seattle. And within a few years, the financial panic of 1893 that swept the nation with bankruptcies and railroad receiverships, including Seattle, Lakeshore, and Eastern and Northern Pacific, strangled the whole operation before any of the four proposed blast furnaces were even constructed. Investors retreated with their funds to lick their wounds from the financial fallout, and workers moved on to find other employment. However, Peter Kirk did not give up on Kirkland. He invested in a local ferry business. He continued to register patents. Even though the mill failure made him leery, he hoped for success. He told the Yakima Herald in 1899, "We invested $300,000 in building the ironworks in Kirkland years ago, but the outcome for any profit is buried in the womb of the future." A page in one of Kirk's little notebooks sketched out the figures for using scrap iron for a mill. According to John Kellett's family, John was making plans to develop this idea right before his death in 1902. Was Kirk helping his old friend? Kirk and his family continued to live in Kirkland for over a decade after the financial crash. The tragedy of his daughter's untimely death in 1904 pressed them to move to their summer home on San Juan Island, where Peter owned a large sheep ranch. He entertained many friends and colleagues at Deer Lodge on San Juan Island, and he often traveled to Seattle and Kirkland to visit them. Living until 1916, Peter Kirk saw Kirkland grow as a community and witnessed the building of the Lake Washington Ship Canal.